and good morning, and welcome to WhatDoesItMean.com. Our special weekly guest is David Icke from London, and good morning, David.
Good morning, David.
Prior to us going on the air here, we were just talking about the Hutton inquiry. Can you inform us a little bit about what's been going on with that?
Well, frankly, anyone with two brain cells on active duty, and there seems to be quite a few of those in relation to their response to this Hutton quote report, can see that it is a complete whitewash and stitch up. The Hutton inquiry was set up by Tony Blair in response to tremendous pressure on him after the death of David Kelly, the weapons expert, particularly expert in the country of Iraq, who spoke to not just one BBC reporter, the man called Andrew Gilligan, who's at the center of this controversy, but also two others. And the thrust of what he said, if not the detail, to all three of them, one of which was taped, is that what was happening is that within the intelligence community in Britain, there were a number of people who were extremely unhappy at the way the British government, led by Tony Blair and spun by a notorious manipulator of information called Alistair Campbell, who he was Blair's head of communications at 10 Downing Street, the way that they were, in one expression, sexing up a intelligence dossier on the potential for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, what they had and what they planned to do with them. They were increasing the language and strengthening the language to sell the Iraq war to the British people through the four-letter word they always use, fear. And David Kelly died after he was exposed as the source of Andrew Gilligan, the BBC's reporter's story, in which he said that he talked to someone, an insider, if you like, who told him about this unease and the way that the dossier was being put together, not on the basis of the intelligence, but on the basis of how strong they could make it to sell this war to Iraq, which, of course, was agreed between Blair and Bush a long time before anyone talked about going to war. So he had to put this inquiry together because of the outrage that this weapons inspector had died. They say it was suicide. I don't believe it for a minute. It reported this week, and the man who Blair appointed to head the inquiry and to come up with these conclusions was a man called Lord Hutton. Now, Lord Hutton is, I guess, the equivalent of a Supreme Court judge in America, and his record on doing anything but supporting the establishment view and protecting the establishment from exposure is there to be seen. There was a former MI5 agent called David Shaler who revealed the illegal manipulations of British intelligence to the public, including attempts to assassinate people, including Colonel Gaddafi. He had to flee to France because he was being pursued under the Official Secrets Act, which is nothing more than an act that keeps secrets from the public or stops the public knowing what's going on behind the scenes. It's used all the time to do that. When the case was heard, one of the people on the bench was Lord Hutton, this man who Blair has picked to put this Hutton inquiry together. And that bench, including Hutton, decreed that David Shaler could not claim he was acting in the public interest by revealing the illegal manipulations of British intelligence. So that's the kind of mindset, establishment mindset, we're dealing with here. The evidence to the Hutton inquiry was heard in public. It was very, very clear from the evidence, so crystal clear, that actually number 10 Downing Street, Alistair Campbell, the communications spinner, and Tony Blair fundamentally were involved in changing the wording of the intelligence dossier on Iraq produced by the intelligence community to make it more fearful to the British public in terms of the threat from Saddam Hussein. One example is that something like 15 words or 15 changes to the wording were suggested by 10 Downing Street to the intelligence community, and all 15 were acted upon. Words like may be a threat became are a threat. May be able to deploy became are able to deploy. And this language increased the strength of the apparent threat from Saddam Hussein. So all this evidence was heard by Lord Hutton, and this week he announced the most unbelievably one-sided, biased conclusion to what happened, in which he cleared 100%, apart from just a few minor officials, 100% Tony Blair, Alistair Campbell, who is the most notorious spinner of information this country's ever been aware of, and the Defense Secretary, Jeff Hoon, who acted appallingly through the whole affair and was exposed in the evidence to the Hutton Inquiry of having lied to the Hutton Inquiry. All these people were cleared for being 100% honest, and the BBC were attacked at every level for reporting, not least the Andrew Gilligan story, that the process of unease was going on within British intelligence about the way this dossier was being used as a propaganda tool, and also that Blair and Campbell knew that their claim that Saddam Hussein could deploy chemical weapons and weapons of mass destruction within 45 minutes, they knew that that was wrong even before it went in the dossier. Now, what has unfolded clearly since and been admitted since is that that claim for Saddam Hussein being able to deploy these weapons of mass destruction in 45 minutes was simply not true. And also, what came out in the Hutton Inquiry is that although British intelligence was saying and knew that even this false allegation of the 45 minutes weapons, you know, kind of claim was actually only applying to battlefield nuclear weapons and not to long-range weapons. When Blair produced this dossier and spoke in the Houses of Parliament saying this is the great threat to Saddam Hussein, he gave the very clear impression that this can deploy in 45 minutes applied to long-range weapons that could hit British targets. So the whole Hutton Inquiry evidence completely supports the clear situation that the dossier was manipulated as a propaganda tool, but Lord Hutton denied in his report that that was anything like that had actually gone on. As a result, we've had the BBC chairman resign. We've had the chief executive, the director general, Greg Dyke, resign yesterday. And so the BBC now and its independence is under a tremendous threat when all that has happened is that a Tony Blair-appointed judge has made conclusions at complete odds with the evidence that presented to him that has supported 100% what Tony Blair wanted him to say.
You know what we're seeing here, and what you've just been describing is something that a lot of us researchers have found over the years on the collusion between the different branches, seemingly separate branches of governments in Western democratic societies. And one of my first experiences was this, was 25 years ago, and I'm sure these names are familiar to you, though they might not be to some of our listening audience. Was in finding that Paul Warburg, who was a close advisor to our President Roosevelt during the 1930s, and he was also the head of the United States Central Banking System, the Federal Reserve, that his policies, in essence, financed the United States military's buildup prior to World War II. But I found it interesting that at the same time that Paul Warburg was fulfilling this function in the United States, that at the exact same time, his brother, Felix Warburg, was also head of the largest private bank, the Deutsche Bank, in Berlin, and was also financing the German military buildup. Can you touch on that for a second, on how seemingly governments are different, yet in actuality, they're all the same?
This is a very, very important point, and it's the level beyond the normal way of looking at the world, and it's the level that people need to get to see the world in and global events in their true context. We are sold constantly the belief from cradle to grave in sides, like this country against that country, this company against that company. All the time, it's us and them, sides. And this is part of a fundamental part of the illusion that allows the few to control the many. Because, quite simply, it's like this. If you want to know the outcome and control the outcome of a football match before it starts, it's no good controlling one side. If you control one side in the football match, you are going to influence the outcome. But no way are you going to know before the first ball is kicked that what that outcome is going to be. So what you need to do to ensure that is control both sides, because then you know what the final result's going to be, because you're manipulating the whole scene. So what you have, for instance, and the excellent example that you talk about, you had the same force working in America and working in Britain and other countries as was working in Germany. And that force, through its, if you like, subsidiary manipulation in the different countries, was orchestrating events to a common aim. So you had one Warburg, for instance, manipulating events in America to suit this agenda of the Second World War and this unbelievable death, destruction, and suffering that was to unfold. You had another Warburg in Germany doing the same. You had expressions of the same network, this Illuminati, illuminated ones, in Britain who were manipulating in the same way, and it was brought together. And what it comes under is something that I call problem reaction solution. Create the problem in the world, make sure someone is blamed for it, get the reaction from the public to your manufactured problem. Do something. We must do something. You must do something. What are you going to do about it? And then a third point, openly offer the solutions to the problems you've created. So the manipulations in Germany that brought the Nazis to power were fundamentally connected to the manipulations in Britain that brought Winston Churchill to power, and also surrounding Roosevelt in America. And so you had an outcome where these different expressions of the same force went to war, though, of course, Roosevelt didn't go to war. Churchill didn't go to war. The people go to war and fight the battles that lead to a solution. And in terms of the Second World War, it was, hey, problem, Second World War in just a short time, reaction from the people, understandably, we must do something, this can't go on, what are they going to do about it? Solution, an explosion of globally centralized institutions in politics, in finance, in all areas of our lives, that after the Second World War, as a result of the manipulations and a result of the conflict and the result of 55 million people losing their lives, we had a situation where the outcome was that fewer, very, very much fewer hands were on the tillers of power after the Second World War than they were before. Exactly the main theme of why the war was manipulated.
You know what? In two times in the last century, World War One and World War Two, we saw that those were two large, great reorganizations of world society. Can you see a parallel occurring right now in this early part of the 21st century?
Yes, I can. See, one of the things that I've found, to my great surprise, although it made absolute sense in my research over the last 14 years, is that this manipulation that we're seeing unfold more and more blatantly and transparently every day goes back a very long time. And this network of interbreeding bloodlines that goes back to the ancient world that became the royal families and kings and queens in the ancient world, and then which we passed through history, became the aristocracy and royal families of Europe, and then through the empires of Europe, not least the British, of course. These bloodlines were expanded all over the world, including to what became the United States. And what has happened through this period of history is that this network, which was fundamentally involved in Babylon, ancient Babylon, has expanded its power across the world, exactly as it always planned to do. Now, one of the fundamental, indeed the fundamental foundation of the few controlling the many, is to centralize decision making. Unless you do that, you cannot control the many. The more diversity you have in decision making, the less power the few are going to have over the many. It's like trying to keep plates on a stage going on sticks, as some of these people do. But if you have too many plates and too many sticks, then eventually you're going to lose control and the plates are going to be crashing everywhere. What you want, ideally, is one big plate on one big stick, because you can stand and keep that going indefinitely from a central point. So what has happened through this period of history is, first of all, we had a tribal situation where relatively few people were making the decisions affecting their lives and their tribe. Then we went to a stage where those tribes were brought together into nations. Now, at that point, many fewer people were actually making the decisions affecting what was before a great diversity of decision-making in the tribal situation. Many fewer were making the decisions affecting all those people. You had a centralization of decision making, and this advanced, and we had nations all over the world. What we went through and are continuing to go through, not least with the setting up of what became the European Union, it was the process of the next stage of this centralization of global power, which was bringing the nations together under a central dictatorship. And that's what we have here in Europe, the European Union. The European Union, formerly known as the EEC, the European Economic Community, was sold to us back in the 50s and 60s as just a free trade area. But that was just the first point in a series of stepping stones, what I call the totalitarian tiptoe, to what it is now, which is a centralized fascist state, literally. If you look at the fasci, the symbol from which the word fascism comes, it's a series of rods tied together with an axe head at the top or an axe head on the side. And what that symbolizes is individuality, the rods tied together and controlled by the axe head, the dictatorship, the central force. In Europe now, the European Union, if the British Parliament, for instance, or any other parliament of the European Union countries, passes legislation that is at odds with European legislation, then European legislation is the one that must preside. It must be the one that is followed, and national legislation simply has to go. We've had a situation in the last few years here of it seems a simple thing, but it really is indicative of just how far this has gone in Europe. We had some market traders here who were selling their fruit and vegetables to their customers in two forms. They were selling them in the old British measurements of pounds and ounces, and in the European Union measurement of the metric system. And they were saying to their customers, which one do you want? How do you want your fruit and vegetables measured? What happened then is council officials came along and said, this is against the law. You cannot offer people your fruit and vegetables under the British system, the old British system. You have to do it under the metric system of the European Union. They were taken to court and charged with breaking European Union legislation. A group of people with some money who were outraged by this funded their appeal to the highest court in the land in Britain over this, where the judges the kind of people that just the kind of people like Lord Hutton, that level, they basically decided that there was no way that the offences could be overturned for these market traders, because it was now the law that any legislation that was not in line with European legislation was illegal. And so we reached that level of centralization of power. Now, the European Union is not actually controlled by elected politicians. It's controlled by the commissioners, these appointed bureaucrats. They're the ones that run Europe and operate this legislation that dictates to every country in the European Union, which of course now is going to expand to more and more. And what this does is create a situation in which the few at the center can now dictate the lives of literally tens of millions of people. The idea, and this is what we're seeing unfold now, is to do this in the Americas and turn NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, Canada, United States, and Mexico, expand that to the whole of the Americas. This was agreed at the summit of the Americas in Quebec, Canada, just after George Bush became president. And that's designed to become the American Union, a mirror of the European Union, with the bureaucrats dictating to the whole of the American continent. They want the same in Africa. About 2 years ago, they changed the name of the Organization of African Unity to the African Union. And what that is designed to evolve into is a centralized dictatorship, European Union, dictating through the whole of Africa. And they also are aiming to turn the APEC free trade zone in the Asia-Australia area, Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation, into their version of the European Union. Now, what they want above that in their structure of dictatorship globally is a world government, a world central bank, a world army. And the world army, I've had journalists say to me, but why do they want a world army? There'd be no one to fight. You know, and I'm looking at them, I'm thinking, you're a journalist, aren't you? Because, of course, why do they want a world army? To impose the will of the world government on countries that won't accept it. What they're looking to do is to now move, and we're seeing it, move to this next stage, this final stage in this agenda, which is a centralized global world government, which would dictate financial and other fundamental policies to the, every country. And then under that would come the European Union, the American Union, the Pacific Union, and the African Union, and then under that would come what we have today, nation states, that will be no more powerful than you know, county councils, really. And under that edifice of power would come people who would have, in the agenda, no ability to have their voices heard. And this is what we're going to, and this is what events now are proceeding to very fast.
Then what you're describing, if we look at the comparisons that we had just talked about of the reordering of the world in World War One and in World War Two, and seemingly that we are now approaching an apex again of a major reordering.
Right.
Do you see that they're going to be doing this in the context of like they did World War One and World War Two and having a World War Three?
Well, funnily enough, I was told by a contact I came across a number of times through the 90s, including one who was a significant CIA scientist who was working against his will, that the aim was to eventually have a conflict with China that would bring about this global structure in the same sense that they said after the Second World War, and indeed after the First World War. After the First World War, they said we must have the League of Nations, which was their first effort to create a centralized global body that would be a stalking horse for moving to a fully-fledged world government. That didn't quite work. So after the Second World War, they brought in the United Nations. Now, the United Nations suited them magnificently for a long time because it was, as I say, another stalking horse, which was designed to evolve, again, through this totalitarian tiptoe, where you know where you're going, but you know if you go from where you are to where you want to go in one leap or too big a leap, then the public are going to look up and say, because the change is so dramatic, what the heck is going on here? So what you do is you go to where you always intend to go in steps along the road, and each step is promoted and projected to the people as completely unconnected to all the other steps. This is how the European Free Trade Zone, the European Economic Community, became the centralized superstate, the European Union, through these stepping stones. And so what you are having now is the situation where the United Nations is constantly being undermined, and the idea is that it be exposed as not relevant anymore to the world as it is now, the fact that it needs more power, it needs more strength, and the movement from the UN as we know it to a fully fledged world government. Now, to bring that about, in any kind of time scale that is worth having, you need again to play a problem, reaction, solution. And just as after the Second World War, as the First World War, as I say, they said, hey, we've got a major problem here. This can't happen again. We must do ABC, and all these centralized global bodies appeared. So if you wish to change global society in a dramatic way, and you wish to offer a global solution that would do that, you clearly need a global problem for which you can offer the global solution. And a conflict with China would do that perfectly. And I've heard it from enough different people that I trust to accept that this is the policy. And then what happens, David? We come across this report by the Project for the New American Century, this organization set up in the 1990s by the very people that control the Bush administration today, people like Cheney and Rumsfeld, Richard Perle, and all these other people that are involved in the so-called neocon network. And what does it say? This report that was published in September 2000, before the Bush administration, with all these characters in it that put the report together, before that came to power. And we see that it talks about invading Iraq. They've done it. It talks about the problem they have to address of Iran and North Korea. What do we have when Bush comes to power? We have a State of the Union address, written apparently by this neocon, David Froom, that came up with this phrase of the axis of evil. Now, who were the axis of evil? Iraq, Iran, and North Korea, precisely the countries named in this Project for the New American Century report as countries that need to be addressed and taken over and their regimes suppressed and replaced. Before the Bush administration came to power. The reason I say all this in relation to China is because also in that report, it talks about the need to have a much greater presence of American troops in Asia, and to bring about, wait for this, the democratization of China. Now, can you imagine what that would mean in terms of conflict and upheaval? So, again, this key name China comes up, even in this report, the one that's come up again and again in my research over the years, and I think that's where it's leading. And interestingly, if you look at North Korea, its northern border borders China. And an interesting and very kind of relevant piece of information is that again and again, because of this problem, reaction, solution scenario that is constantly played, you find that those, even the same characters who are offering the solution to a problem, are the very people who are involved in creating the problem. For instance, North Korea is a threat to the world, according to Donald Rumsfeld, the defense secretary, because it has nuclear technology. What he doesn't say is that in the year 2000, a giant European engineering company called ABB sold that nuclear technology to North Korea. On the board of ABB at that time and for 11 years before was a man called Donald Rumsfeld. And when you do the research, as you have found, of course, as well, is that you find that again and again, those who stand up and say we must do something about this problem turn out to be involved in creating the problem in the first place.
Okay, now, in keeping in mind that problem reaction solution scenario, in that a problem has to be created, one thing that a lot of our listeners are concerned about has to do with events occurring with this mysterious Planet X and everything having to do with it. I give you an example, too. On January the 14th, a large comet hit the sun. Within 10 minutes of that, a large volcano erupted in Kamchatka, which is in Russia. Another one erupted in southern Japan, and another one erupted in Ecuador. That, is it possible that the one world government, or that there is a prepositioning for the imposition of it following not just a manufactured disaster, but a known disaster that could be soon to occur because of the effects on the Earth, earthquakes, volcanoes, etc., from the effects extraterrestrial?
I think that is certainly possible because the people we're talking about, two things. First of all, these people obviously are in receipt of knowledge that is not in the public domain, which is why people like you and me and so many others focus their lives on uncovering as much of that information as possible and communicating it. So there are there is information and knowledge that they know that we don't know. So you're always being silly, really, if you dismiss the possibility of anything, because how can you dismiss something when you don't know vast amounts of information that is relevant? So yes, it's possible, and for sure, the extraterrestrial and I would say interdimensional expression of this manipulation is key to understanding it. You know, people have said to me, and it's an understandable question, why would over thousands of years in our version of time, why would all these different people dedicate their lives to manipulating towards this goal of global control, when they knew they were going to be long gone before it happened? And that's a very relevant question, and it needed addressing. And what is clearly the case for me, from my research, is that this Illuminati, this, if you like, human or apparently human level of the manipulation, the George Bushes, the Tony Blairs, but more crucially, the people behind them where the real power is, they may appear to be human on one level, but that's not the key level in which this whole agenda of global control is being manipulated. If you look at the ancient texts all over the world, if you talk, as I have, to hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people all over the world from every different walk of life you can imagine, it's very clear that there is some non-human interdimensional phenomenon going on here in which the human level is merely the facade behind which hide the real entities behind this manipulation. There was a movie made by John Carpenter some years ago called They Live, which was portraying a non-human race, a non-human force that was manipulating this world to its own agenda and its own ends by hiding within human form. Now, if you look again throughout the ancient world and the accounts from the ancient world, look at all the legends and beliefs of native peoples around the world. Look at the experiences that people from all walks of life are having but don't get told through the mainstream media. And you find that this age-old phenomenon of, quote, possession of another entity taking over the mental, emotional thought processes and feeling processes of a human being is absolutely constant. And when you have spoken and met the number of people that I have around the world who have, again, from every walk of life, from people in the banking system and all these different areas of life, who've spoken of having this same basic experience of seeing someone, often in positions of power, though not always, appear human to them and then transform before their eyes into a very non-human, overwhelmingly in the accounts, reptilian form, and then come back again. And then you scan the ancient accounts and you find that this phenomenon is reported all over the ancient world. When you talk to people like the official historian of the Zulu nation, Credo Mutwa in South Africa, who says that this phenomenon is fundamental to their beliefs and what they've experienced and what's been passed on through this shamanistic stream for centuries, the common theme is very clear, although the mainstream media and mainstream conditioned thought, it's too much for them. That these human manipulators are actually just a five-sense front for entities that are very anything but human, and that they are manipulating this reality, this five-sense reality we call the physical world. Now, because they are operating or able to move between the five-sense world and their own world outside the frequency range of the five senses, it means that they don't actually operate outside of this realm to the same timeline that we do. And it's almost like running up and down the timeline of the five-sense reality, coming in and out of it by possessing apparently human bodies through the timeline, which brings about a very simple situation. The very same entities that were manipulating in the ancient world are the same entities that are manipulating this world at this point in the timeline, and therefore there's the common theme of why people years ago, sometimes thousands of years ago, were manipulating towards this agenda of global control when they were going to be long gone before it arrived. The five sense level was just the facade, if you like, as brilliantly portrayed in the They Live movie. When you're dealing with that level of phenomena, then the idea that planets that the general public don't know of are involved and are affecting the Earth in a way that these manipulators understand becomes pretty small deal, really. Anything is possible. And also, as I've gone into in a new book called Tales from the Time Loop, while people find this shape-shifting, non-human phenomena extremely challenging, and I understand that because we're conditioned from cradle to grave to believe in the most tiny prison of possibility and potential. But when you go into the nature of reality and how we create it, which quantum physics is now exposing very clearly, that the physical world that we think is around us is not physical and is an illusion, then there is absolutely nothing that is impossible. And what I've understood, particularly in the last year more than ever before, is that the very bottom line foundation of this whole manipulation is the manipulation of our beliefs. Because the more we understand about how we create reality, the more clear it is that what we believe is real is what we experience as real. Until I got into this research deeply for Tales from the Time Loop, I didn't realize that when information enters the eyes, it's in nothing like the form that we see around us or think we see around us as a physical world. When that information enters the eyes, it is two-dimensional, it's upside down, and in a completely different form to that we think we're looking at. It only becomes the three-dimensional world we think is around us when that information hits the visual cortex in the brain. It's not like the world we think we're looking at until it hits that visual cortex. Now, as experimentation has shown in mainstream science, between the information entering the eyes and hitting the visual cortex to become the world we think is around us and we're looking at, a massive editing process takes place in terms of the detail. now, David, I'm talking at great length to Credo Mutwa, this official historian of the Zulu nation, a library on legs, this man. And I said to him, look, if all these kind of non-human entities are around us, why don't people see, people do see them, but why don't more people see them? And he said, all these years ago, before I realized about this editing process that I've just described, he said, because they are so fantastic compared with what people believe can exist and people believe they're looking at, that they edit them out of the scene and they don't register in the brain. And all these years later, I find that what this apparently primitive man in the black African bush was telling me is absolutely spot on. And so this brings about a very, very clear situation. He who can implant belief can, through that belief, dictate the experienced reality of the person. And I mentioned in the book a wonderful story that really sums up what I'm saying here. It was in another book called The Holographic Universe by a man called Michael Tolbert, excellent book from the early 90s, in which he tells a story in there that he actually experienced. He said that his father hosted a party for friends at his home and invited a stage hypnotist along to do his party tricks. He got people to believe in a hypnotic state that there was a giraffe in the room or an elephant in the room or the person next to them was naked and all this stuff that stage hypnotists do. In fact, in researching Time Loop, I went to two stage hypnotist shows to observe this phenomenon at work. And eventually in this party, Tolbert recounts that there was a man called Tom, and he was put through the whole hypnotic party trick situation. But just before he was brought out into apparently a waking state, the hypnotist said to him, when I bring you back to a waking state, you are not going to be able to see your daughter. The man is sitting down in a chair, and the old fingers are flicked and whatever, and the man comes back to what he thinks is a waking state. By this time, the hypnotist has led the daughter to stand right in front of her father. So this guy's sitting down looking into her midriff. The hypnotist then said to him, can you see your daughter in the room? He couldn't. And his daughter starts giggling, and he can't hear it. The hypnotist then goes behind the daughter and pushes something in the small of her back and says to the father, what am I holding in my hand? And looking bewildered, because it was so obvious, he said, you're holding a watch. He then said, there's an inscription on the watch. Can you read it? He leaned forward and read the inscription. So he is reading something and seeing something that is behind his daughter, which in what we would consider normal reality would be impossible. But what's happened here is very simple. The information has entered the eyes of the guy with the daughter in the room. Of course, she's standing in front of him. It's then gone through this editing process and gone through this implanted hypnotic belief that his daughter's not in the room. And at that point, he has edited his daughter out of the scene. So by the time it hits the visual cortex at the back of the brain, there is no daughter in his reality. Now, when you apply this to the manipulation of the mass of the people, it's exactly the same. We have a hypnotist in the corner of every room virtually in the world now, in the Western world anyway, the television. We have the laughingly described education system in which a version of reality, belief in reality, is sold to children from a very early age right through school and university and college and all the rest of it. We have around us people who have been through this same hypnotic process of having their sense of reality implanted through this education system and through this this mainstream media that parrots the official version of life. And so they are also confirming to us that the belief in reality that we've taken on is right because they've taken on the same belief. And what this has created, David, is a global population that is as much in a hypnotic hypnotic state as anyone on the stage of a stage hypnotist. And when we talk about the Great Awakening, where more and more people are opening their minds and seeing beyond the minute version of reality that we are led to believe is real, what we're seeing is literally these people, as what happened to me in the early 90s in a very, very dramatic way, is that they are waking up from the hypnotic trance. If you go to a stage hypnotist show, and I've been there, and you see people on the stage, they are reacting in terms of their behavior and belief to the implanted realities of the hypnotist. Now, once the hypnotist clicks their fingers and those people wake up, they're now looking at a completely different reality, nothing like the one they've been behaving and reacting to while the show's been going on. And this is what is happening when people wake up. And this is why when people do start to wake up from the hypnotic trance of this implanted belief in reality and what's going on in the world and all that stuff, they see the world immediately in completely different terms to how they did before. Now, what this means is suddenly someone wakes up. It's like someone, if you like, on the stage with a lot of people at the hypnotist show, one of them wakes up from the trance. Now, he wakes up and he's trying to say to these other people who are still in the trance, hey, you know, there's no giraffe in the room. There's no giraffe in the room. It's an illusion. Oh, no, the woman's not naked. She's got clothes on. It's an illusion. And, of course, all these people in the hypnotic trance on the stage are going, you're mad. How can you say that? I can see the giraffe. She ain't got any clothes on. I can see it. And this is why when people wake up and start to see the world in a different way, they are so completely at odds with people around them because they're continuing to see the world in the trance state that you were in before. So this is what the whole basis of the manipulation is the manipulation of our sense of reality, because they know that if they can implant that, it will become our experienced reality in the way that I've described.
Now, it's interesting that you bring up this subject matter. Let me just tell you a quick story. Back in the late 70s, there began a concentrated effort by the United States government and many other governments to ban smoking and to outlaw smoking, which up till then had been an acceptable behavior, acceptable vice. And now this has nothing to do with the evils or of the health risk of smoking, but what I found in my research, and I found this in a book down in Roanoke, Virginia, about what tobacco was originally used for by the Indian tribes, that whenever there was a big meeting of tribes or within a tribe of leaders, and before any decision was made, they would smoke a pipe which had tobacco in it. And the reason for them doing this, they said, was because if you had tobacco in you, that you could not be influenced by any other entity. And that's really how it translated.
Right.
Which led me on to a further research that, yes, indeed, the world, the ancient world, does appear to have a base knowledge of a multidimensional force around us, existence around us, but that could be entered by mushrooms, different plants from around the world. And what surprised me was that there is not one continent or one culture you can touch base with that does not have in their base knowledge something about this, which also coincides with what we're going through these days. And how we have seen in the past century alone the rise of anti-drug legislation seemingly out of all proportion and out of all common sense, because all the research that you read shows that the wars on drugs from whatever country they've come from have not stopped crime, but have in fact increased crime.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a very, very important point, and it's part of a much bigger point, which is that we are multidimensional beings. I mean, just look at quantum physics. There is no point where they can show a division between one thing and another. The level of subatomic energy, if you like, the level of energy in its true form, there is one infinite energy field, one infinite consciousness. The divisions are merely illusions of the five-sense mind. So we are not a droplet of water in the ocean, which is what we're led to believe. Oh, you're just an ordinary man in the street. You've got no power. You're just a little droplet in the ocean. And, you know, I give your power to me because I'll tell you what to think because you're only small and insignificant. If you put a droplet of water in an ocean, tell me where the ocean starts and the droplet starts. The droplet is now the ocean. The idea, therefore, or the problem for the manipulators is those that hold this connection in awareness to the ocean of consciousness have tapped in to infinite possibility, infinite wisdom, infinite knowledge, infinite love, and all these infinite understanding. So you try manipulating one person in that multi-dimensional infinite state, never mind 6 billion of them. So what you need to do is to disconnect people from that multi-dimensional infinity so they're operating on a fraction of their potential. And to do that, you need to hold them in the five-sense reality. If you look at society today, it is absolutely geared to enticing and intoxicating the five senses. Taste, sight, sound, all of this stuff, to hold us in five-sense reality, to hold us in a mesmerized state, looking at the headlights of the oncoming car. Now, anything, therefore, David, that you quite rightly point out, anything that can help us move beyond the five senses in awareness to realize that we are not just a physical body, in fact, that's the least of what we are, is a very dangerous to those that want to hold us in this five-sense mind prison. So what they've done systematically through the centuries is take out of circulation, not least by making it illegal or demonizing it, anything that would give us the opportunity to move beyond the five-sense realm and to see an awareness, not by some theoretical, I think that's how it is, but actually to experience reality beyond the five senses and to realize this is just one frequency range in infinity. And so you have this attack, this systematic attack on anything that would do that. I mean, I put something on my website the other day. It was a story pointing out that alcohol, which makes so many people aggressive and causes tremendous violence as a result of its influence, is okay and is sold in the local store. You know, go anywhere and you can buy alcohol. But something like cannabis or whatever, which I personally haven't tried, but I've seen other people who have, and I've never seen anyone taking cannabis that was in anything but a calm, serene state. So, you know, something that stimulates violence in so many people, it can be sold in the local store. Something that brings about a calmness in people is illegal. I mean, excuse me, something wrong here. And I am, as I explain in some detail in Time Loop, had an experience for the first time. I got to the age of 50, a year ago, without taking anything of this kind. But I got invited to go down to the Amazon rainforest in Brazil and take something called ayahuasca, which is made from a rainforest plant and has been used by shaman in South America for at least hundreds of years to help people go into another state of reality in awareness and experience it. And I'd reached the point when I'd finished a book called Alice in Wonderland and the World Trade Center Disaster, where I was saying to my wife, you know, if I'm going to take this story on, if I'm going to understand more about what is actually going on in the world, I've got to go in awareness beyond it and look at it from outside. And so I jumped at the chance to go down and participate in this. And interestingly, David, the reason the group asked me to go down was because so many people who had taken ayahuasca and gone into other states of reality had reported seeing reptilian mine went to. So I went down and I took it twice, but I took it four times. Two was enough for me. And I had two nights, totaling, I guess, 7 hours, where I went into a level of reality that was beyond this world, or this illusion, to a place where everything was everything else. There was no point. Well, I was still self-aware. I was still aware of me as a droplet, if you like. But I was also the ocean. There was no point where I ended and everything else began. And it was a place of utter bliss. There was no fear. There was no guilt. There was none of these emotions that hold us in servitude down here, or not down here because it's all sharing the same space, but in this reality. And I was able over these 7 hours to learn a lot of very profound, very simple information about how this world we think is real is actually generated by our minds, and the basis of on which it's generated is our belief in what is real. When you've been in that state, it gives you a totally different perspective on the world you think is around you, and makes it makes you even more at odds with people who are still believing that this place is real, and all the old deeply flawed scientific explanations for this world.
That ties in. I did some work at the University of Cincinnati back in the early 80s, and one of the projects that I was able to witness, wasn't a participant, was able to witness, was a controlled study of people that volunteered to take a chemical called DMT.
Yeah.
One thing that just astounded me was, and I was in the project as one of the interviewers of the people that had these experiences, and one thing that was incredible was that every single one believed that they were seeing a reality that exists with us, that exists, coexists with us right now.
Right.
But it was like a curtain had been drawn back to show them what it really was. And
yep.
For many of them, it was just frightening, and this touches on what you said before, that it was so frightening that the vast majority of them said they would never want to have that experience again because it was so shattering to what they believed reality is and was. And many of them talked about reptilian beings being there.
Well, that's interesting from my research for a start. But funny enough, this substance DMT you talk about, that's actually in ayahuasca, I was told. I understand it's a naturally occurring substance, but these substances give it a real boost. And so that makes absolute sense to me. But interestingly, what happened to me in one session of this ayahuasca anyway is that I was spoken to by a female voice, that's the way it expressed itself, in that was just as loud as mine is now talking to you. I mean, it wasn't, oh, God, what did it say? It was as loud as this one. And it talked for 5 hours about the nature of reality and how we manipulate it. And one of the things it says was, and this was the key thing, it said right at the start, all you really need to know, because everything else comes from it, is this. Infinite love is the only truth. Everything else is illusion. And my mind went to say, you mean everything. And before I'd actually formed the thought, the voice came back and said, everything. Infinite love is the only truth. Everything else is illusion. And it went on to say this, that the only truth is that everything is one infinite consciousness. Everything else beyond that truth is the imagination of that consciousness made manifest in all its different forms. And because we are droplets in the ocean, therefore we are the ocean, we are also part of that one consciousness that is manifesting that imagination that is manifesting in our experience now in the world we think is real and around us, but as quantum physics and other experimentation has shown, cannot be around us, it has to be inside of us. The other thing that it said was, at one point, do you think the ayahuasca has brought you to this place? And I thought, well, I took it, and I'm here. And she said, no, your belief in the ayahuasca, your sense of reality of the ayahuasca brought you to this place. Ayahuasca is as much an illusion as anything else. And the other thing it said was that ayahuasca will not take you anywhere. It will only help, because of your belief, take you to where you already are. So if you're in a real bad, low emotional, dark, if you like, emotional state, then that is where, that is what you will experience in another reality. Your mind will just manifest that state of being in another way. And if you're in a good space and in a high space, then you'll go to something that reflects that. I heard this great phrase years ago, death is no cure for ignorance. And when we lose this reality of what we call death, you know, we don't become immediately enlightened. We go on reflecting our state of being in our experience, just in a different frequency range, a different dimension of reality. So when I was writing Time Loop, and I was writing in that part of the experience where it said the ayahuasca hasn't brought you here, your belief in it has, because everything is belief. I was flipping through another book a few minutes afterwards and reading about this LSD experiment in which they gave some people LSD and they gave some people a placebo that wasn't LSD. And a number of the people who took the placebo went out on an LSD trip every bit as much as powerful as those actually took the LSD. Everything is mind, everything is belief, and we experience what we believe is real. And so this is the very foundation of how the global population is manipulated to believe a reality and therefore experience it.
Do you see a conflict between human beings and an entity from this other dimension?
Well, when people talk about the subconscious mind and other dimensions, it's like, you know, that we're talking about infinity. We have a subconscious mind that is close to the conscious mind frequency range, but that subconscious mind is merely going out into infinity like everything else. But we have infinity out there, infinity of possibility. This is why it's quite amusing to me when people say, "What do you mean, reptilian entities? That's mad." Well, I mean, crikey, within this tiny, tiny frequency range, and that's all it is. It's the frequency range of the five senses that we think is everything there is. It's just the frequency range of the five senses. I'm looking out of my eyes now, and I am not seeing everything that exists in the space I'm looking at. I'm seeing that frequency range, but my sight and my five senses can access. This is why people have cats and other animals, but cats are very sensitive particularly. And you'll see a cat actually jumping around, reacting to what is to us empty space. And we go, what's wrong with the bloody cat? He's gone mad. But the cat is not seeing empty space. It has a greater visual frequency range. So it's seeing things in the space that we're looking at that we can't see. So when you, in this tiny, tiny frequency range we call the five sense world, when you look at the unbelievable diversity of form that there is, imagine the diversity of form that exists beyond it, in the infinite. From my own research, David, and talking to endless people over these years, I've been doing this full-time, literally full-time for 14 years, traveled to more than 40 countries now researching this. These entities that are operating just outside the five sense frequency range and have the ability to come into it and go out of it, which is why this, you know, one reason for this phenomenon where people see someone apparently human, then they see someone anything but human, and then human again, is because they have they have the ability to move between the frequency range. So it's almost literally like now you see it, now you don't. Now it's in your frequency range. Hey, did you see that out of the frequency range? Hey, it disappeared in front of my eyes. You're mad. It can't happen because it hasn't disappeared. It's left the frequency range that person can access. And these entities that operate, and they seem to take predominantly reptilian form, though not totally. They do have an agenda for manipulating this reality. And of course, it's like, I guess guess you could say it's like in these laboratories where you have these tanks, and this, what's in the tank is not good to come into contact with. So what they have are these like arms and gloves that go into the tank, and the scientists go to the side of the tank, put their arms in these long gloves, and they can work inside the tank without being harmed by what's inside. Symbolically, that seems to be what's going on here. These entities that operate just outside this frequency range work through a five-sense, quote, human form to manipulate this world, and they do it by taking over their mental and emotional processes and therefore dictating their behavior. And it's one of the reasons, and again, this has come up so much over these years, it's one of the reasons why the Illuminati are so obsessed with what you might term satanic ritual, blood rituals, rituals that involve human sacrifice. We have this belief that yes, there was human sacrifice a long time ago, but we've all grown up now. Well, actually, human sacrifice, and this is the thing that staggered me when I came across it, was not that it went on, but the scale of it is absolutely extraordinary. And someone said to me, who's in America, who has had tremendous experience and done an enormous amount of research into the subject of Satanism, he said that, you know, if you have a reasonable circle of friends and acquaintances, if you know someone who's a Satanist and is involved in human sacrifice and blood drinking ritual, that's the scale we're talking about. And this is why, again and again, when I've researched the background to these key players in global politics and global banking and all these institutions that dictate our lives and are advancing this agenda for the global state, again and again you find that they're involved in these rituals of blood and sacrifice. And one of the reasons is, and people who've taken part in them against their will have told me this, that one of the reasons for them is that they create in the ritual an energy environment, an energy field that allows these entities just beyond the five senses to come and manifest themselves in the five sense realm, and they can interact with them. Another thing that happens is that this ritual energy environment brings about a shape shifting in the participants, where the real entity manifests itself beyond and over shadows the apparently human level. And I remember I was talking to a lady in America who was the head of, I think they call it Parents Against Ritual Abuse, which is about exposing the ritual abuse of children. And in the middle of this conversation, and I hadn't gone public at this time in any way, shape, or form about this whole reptilian phenomenon, she said to me, because I was just talking to her about ritual abuse, that was the point of the conversation, and in the middle of it, she said, I wonder if you could help me with something. She said, can you explain to me why so many of my clients, those that have been abused in rituals, say that the participants turned into reptiles? She said, do you think they're dressing up as reptiles to confuse them? And this phenomenon of the reptilian thing involving the rituals has come up over and over and over and over again. And so another reason for the rituals is literally to create an environment in which these entities can possess and take over a human form. And one of the processes that they use is that there are certain bloodlines that go back to the ancient world. And indeed, you know, there are endless accounts in the ancient world about non-human entities interbreeding with humans to create a hybrid race. Often these non-human entities were perceived as the gods. And this is where the age-old idea comes from of royalty and the divine right to rule. What is the divine right to rule? It is the right to rule because of your genetics. We have a lady about an hour and a half from me, Queen Elizabeth II in London, who is only head of state in Britain because of her bloodline. If she did not have her particular bloodline, then she would maybe be cleaning the throne, not sitting on it. That's how ludicrous it all gets. And when you pick up these ancient hybrid bloodlines, the quote royal bloodlines of this interbreeding eons ago, and not always eons ago either, and you follow them through these bloodlines, you find, as I said earlier, that they go from being the ancient kings and queens to being the aristocracy and royal families of Europe. And then when the people started to reject this overt royal dictatorship, they started to go and move these bloodlines into other areas of control. They became far more hidden. They went into politics. They went into banking. They went into business. They went into, in the modern world, media ownership. And so the question when I was doing this research was, why are they obsessed? Why are they obsessed with genetics? Why are they obsessed with bloodline? Why is entry to the upper levels of this Illuminati pyramid by bloodline only? And the result in research and experiences and people I spoke to came up with this simple answer. The interbreeding created a DNA that has a particular resonance that is sympathetic to the resonance of these entities just beyond the five senses. And so these particular bloodlines can be, quote, possessed by these entities far more easily because of this sympathetic resonance than with the general population that is not part of this interbreeding. And so these bloodlines, these people in control, they want to hold this particular DNA combination because of this resonance. And this is why throughout the centuries, right to the present day, we have this obsession among not just the royal families, but also the aristocracy and also the, quote, ruling classes like the Eastern Establishment of the United States, this obsession with interbreeding with each other. And the more I've researched this, it is done on a mega scale. It's done by artificial means so that one man and one woman will produce a child that has the right genetics and hold that genetic structure. It's done in breeding programs where one person who has a particularly pure expression of this bloodline, this DNA, will, through artificial means, father endless numbers of children with endless numbers of women who have a compatible genetic, so the child will produce what is required in terms of genetics. Why? Because that means that they have the physical five-sense, quote, human vehicle for which these entities can come in and possess them, not least in these rituals that they set up. And one other level of this is that the vast majority of these people who have this DNA, what is described to me by an insider as a corruption of the DNA, a DNA corruption, they have no idea outside of the major families that they have it or that it even exists. But they keep a real close eye on who has it and who hasn't. And the Mormon kind of genetic library, if you like, the family trees that they research so much in the Mormon church have been used to ascertain who has and who hasn't had got this DNA corruption. And this is the real reason, David, behind all the smoke screens, why they want a global DNA database. It's not to do with catching crime. That's just the cover story. It's to find out exactly who has and who hasn't. And what happens then is, and I've talked to people who've been targeted like this, someone who has this DNA corruption but has no idea is starting to show real great ability or aptitude in politics or in law or in banking or whatever area that they are focused on. And suddenly, they start to get sponsored and supported by very, very powerful people. And suddenly, if they're politicians, the funding starts and the support starts and all these powerful people start supporting them. And to them, they get the impression that, hey, you know, it's just because I'm good or I'm lucky or whatever. But what's really happening is that someone with abilities that the Illuminati want and the has the bloodline is being targeted. And what happens then is they start to bring them into the secret society network. And I've talked to endless bloody Freemasons over the years, and the vast overwhelming majority haven't got a clue what all these rituals are about. Oh, you know, we pull our trouser leg up and bare our breast and all that stuff and say these words, parrot fashion. I don't know what it's all about. Anyway, they do a good meal, you know, and all that stuff. Oh, you can do a bit of good business with your fellow Freemasons in the local, you know, business community. But what's really happening, and of course this is expanded far more the higher you go up the secret society network, where the rituals get more and more powerful, is that they're being drawn in so that this possession can take place. And these rituals are not just there because of some ancient tradition. They're there because of the effect they have. And again and again, you talk to people who used to know years ago someone who's now very famous and powerful in politics or banking or whatever, and they'll say to you, you know, that's not the same person that I knew. Ain't the same person. He had principles once, you know. And people say, oh, yeah, but his absolute power corrupts and power corrupts and all that stuff. But there's another reason for it, and that is literally, in terms of their mental and emotional processes, they ain't the same person, because something else has moved in as a result of the process I've talked about, and more dominated the thoughts and emotions of that person, and therefore more and more dominated their behavior and actions. And this is happening all the time. And this is why, you know, people say, oh, it's just paranoia. You're seeing Satanists everywhere and manipulators everywhere at the top of politics and all this stuff. And it's not that you're seeing them everywhere. It's that the system is set up so that anyone that isn't is filtered out before they reach that level of power by scandal, by not getting the jobs that their ability should get them. And only those in power are those real power are those that are of the bloodline and are of this, in this possessed state. And so at the top of power in the world, politics, banking, business, media ownership, the ratio of these people to positions of power is fantastic compared with the ratio of these people in the general population. And this is why it's not paranoia. It's the fact the system makes sure that the positions of power are packed with these people. And therefore, as we began when we this chat, they have their representatives in all these apparently unconnected areas, whether it's as lawyers and judges or bankers or politicians. And so when a situation needs to arise and decisions are necessary to support the agenda or protect people from exposure who are working to the agenda, then the right decisions are made. It's because there is a common theme and a common network that connects the people that are the subject of the decisions and are the people making the decisions. That's why the right decisions invariably are made to suit those in power whenever necessary.
Well, Dave, one thing that is common knowledge, every conversation with you leads to a million more questions.
I know.
But
it's because, in the end, as you will have found also, if you research anything for long enough in this area, the strands start to connect, and everything connects to everything else.
That's true. And in finishing up here, Dave, can you give our listeners information on how to get to your website and how to order your books?
Yeah, they can do both at the same place. If they go to davidicke.com, and it's I-C-K-E, they can get the books. And the webmaster is a very, very efficient operation. They should get them very quickly, within 48 hours, often. So if they go to davidicke.com, that would be the place to go.
Yes, and you can also click on David Icke's name underneath where you click to listen to this program, and that will also bring you to David Icke's website. And, David, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure, David. Thanks so much.
Okay, and you have a good day, sir.
You too.